Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening and supporting public radio. The color of wealth in South Florida is mostly white. A new study finds a major wealth gap across racial and ethnic groups here in South Florida. The report is called The Color of Wealth. It shows that black people, no matter their nationality, fare worse economically than white Americans or other groups that identify as white. For example, 43% of South Florida's population is Hispanic. But according to this study, when broken down by race, white Hispanics have better economic outcomes than black Hispanics. The report also looked at home ownership, education, and things like bank accounts and stocks and bonds. So what's been your experience with finances here in South Florida? Let's talk about money and race. How have you dealt with finding affordable housing, transportation, access to jobs, economic mobility, vulnerability, for instance, your experience with wealth, money, and race here in South Florida? That's up first here on the South Florida Roundup. You can join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. That's the phone number to talk to us. You can also send us a text at 786-786-7636. The text line is 786-786-7636. And of course, we are also on social media, Facebook and Twitter at WLRN. WLRN reporter Nadege Green is with us, and two authors of this study who helped this research in South Florida with us as well. Gretchen Biesing is the CEO of Catalyst Miami. It's a nonprofit that addresses issues concerning low wealth families. And Dr. Danielle Cleland is with us from our studios inside the Miami Herald in Doral. She's a professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University. To all three of you, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Dr. Cleland, let me start here. How sharp is the racial divide when it comes to wealth in South Florida? What did you find?
Well, you know, when we look at, for instance, household median net worth, we look at white household median net worth at $107,000, whereas U.S. black net worth, $3,700, Caribbean black, $12,000. And when we look at Cuban, for instance, it's also very low when compared to white median net worth at $22,000. So really, we're looking at nearly $100,000 gap for many groups when compared to white. And that's not only for black folks, that's also for Cubans, Puerto Ricans, South Americans.
A lot to dig in there, and we'll get there. But what does net worth mean? What goes into that calculation?
So this is actually just household median net worth. And so that is essentially, this report looks at assets, private assets.
So this would be things like your home, your car, the stuff inside your house, your bank account,
kind of stuff. Yes, that kind of stocks.
Stocks, yes. But yeah, any kind of retirement investments that you may have and whatnot. Yeah.
Yes.
Gretchen, what struck you about this report as someone who works across the South Florida community? You've been here for a good number of years. What really kind of resonated with you with this data?
I think for us, this report really validated a lot of things that my staff were experiencing working in low-wealth communities of color across the county. And in particular, one of the findings that really struck me had to do with the median value of liquid assets for these families. So the median value for U.S. blacks is $11. In the Miami MSA.
$11. Yep. So on average, a black household in South Florida has access to $11.
That's right. And, for us, we really see this come to light after events like Hurricane Irma or the federal government shutdown, when people don't have access to their regular income. They're not able to restock their fridges. They're not able to pay bills. That's when we see folks come out.
The phone number to call, 800-743-9576. Have a conversation about wealth and race here in South Florida, 800-743-9576. Of course, you can also send us a text at 786-786-7636. The text line, 786-786-7636. Nadege Green, how about for you, the takeaways from this data?
I think one of the things with this research that I really appreciated, and I think should happen more, is really breaking out what we mean when we say black and white, especially in a community like Miami. So, like, through this research, you saw that, for example, if you identified as white Hispanic, whether white Colombian, white Cuban, your outcome was vastly different or starkly different than if you identified as Black Hispanic. We tend to lump in Latino Hispanic into one category. Mm-hmm. But this study and a few others recently, there was a criminal justice study that looked at the outcome of Black versus white Hispanics in the criminal justice system in Miami. And we found that Black Hispanics fared worse. So whiteness and proximity to whiteness means different things in this community, regardless of your nationality. And I think that was very important.
We know in South Florida, perhaps better than anybody else, how racial identity is not monolithic. Based upon the binary color of Black, brown, and white.
Correct, correct. And even within the Black community in Miami, outcomes are different if you are a Black immigrant versus if you're U.S.-born Black, mm-hmm. right? And so the studies saw that if you were Haitian, Jamaican, or Trinidadian, you were more likely to be a homeowner than if you were U.S.-born Black. The study does not unpack that, but I think it's important to note that there is a long history of redlining. Yep. I mean, from enslavement to, you know, the
housing
civil rights era, housing discrimination to Jim Crow, yep. that disproportionately there is a discrimination that is very specific to a U.S.-born African-American experience that may not necessarily translate if you are a Black immigrant first generation, mm. because there is this divide over who is accepted. Mm-hmm. And because of that specific discrimination towards African Americans, there are job opportunities that people will say, well, I would rather hire a Black immigrant versus a U.S. Mm. born Black. And the implications of that is real.
Text comment from area code 757, a little bit to this point, saying whites have generational money and Blacks earn their money within their lifetime. That's what I believe. I'm a professional, but all my savings goes mm-hmm. into my school loans and not to my children for their future. Dr. Cleland, how does that square with what you found in the community?
Well, I think one of the most important things that I want to emphasize here is that we chose to look at wealth because education and income cannot explain the wealth gap. So a lot of us think, well, if I work hard, if I go to college, then I can reverse some of these trends. But actually, you know, those that are going to college, for instance, or Blacks that are going to college have less wealth than whites who have dropped out of high school. And so the idea here is that, you know, studying hard and working hard is not going to change this, right? These are structural issues that go beyond just what we do as individuals.
Yeah. So Gretchen, so what Dr. Cleland is saying is the bootstrap philosophy isn't in play in South Florida,
or in the U.S.
The grind it out, the grit, you'll make it, the never quit. That isn't necessarily the way toward income growth and economic mobility and wealth.
It's definitely not the way towards income growth and economic mobility. My parents used to tell me that the way to make money is to invest or find legal ways to avoid paying taxes. And I want to just note that no one in my family is a financial advisor by profession. So
it's not tax advice you're giving then right now.
Yeah, definitely not.
Understood.
Please don't go and avoid taxes, please. But I think when you consider this kind of advice and also you layer in the importance of inheritance, and the intergenerational wealth transfer. I mean, that's really what drives white wealth in our country. And these are mechanisms that most low-wealth families, especially low-wealth families of color, just don't have access to. It's very difficult to begin investing money when you don't make a living wage, mm-hmm. Which is why I think for us locally, it's really important to look at the kind of the different levers that are available for building wealth across communities.
Talking about race and wealth here in South Florida could be uncomfortable topics, but we invite your input. 800-743-9576. What experiences do you have with wealth, income, and race? 800-743-9576 to talk to us. You could also send us a text, 786-786-7636. In Kendall, John is on line one. You've got a data statistical question of sorts, John. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just wondering where are the figures that your guest quoted in terms of net worth for the different groups, Black, white, Hispanic, come from? Because this kind of information, the only accurate way I would know to get it is to actually have access to someone's bank account, retirement account, things like that. Mm-hmm. And how is How is she getting the numbers that are accurate?
Fair enough. Check and trust and verify here, John. How about it, Dr. Cleland? Where did these? How were you able to gather the household data? Were you able to? Did folks share with you checking accounts and property appraisals?
Yeah, so this was essentially a survey that called the National Asset Scorecard for Communities of Color. It's been done in several cities. Miami is one of them. And we did it through phone surveys. And so people disclosed their assets in that way. Some of the information about wealth we also have gathered from the census.
From the Census Bureau, which gathers its own kind of wealth information.
Yes.
Nadege Green, you mentioned several types of studies that have shown racial differences. You know, help walk us through some of the historical context, certainly here in South Florida.
It's the historical context across this nation that a lot of wealth, was built off of slavery, right? Mm-hmm. And even from that, you had like the Land Act of 1785, where pretty much the government gave away land, but you could only get land if you were a white man.
Right.
So when you talk about intergenerational wealth, right, that those things add up over time. Versus if you were black in America, there's a good chance your wealth building did not really happen until the 1960s. That's not a very long time. And a lot of that wealth was structured in real estate, right? So you were a homeowner. But we saw this huge bust, right? The housing bust disproportionately impacted people of color. So we saw a loss of wealth in the black community. But even with that, access to mortgages are increasingly difficult still today, even post redlining. There are all of these barriers that still exist if you're a person of color trying to get a home, which is real estate is one of the ways you're told you can build wealth.
Right.
Jobs with benefits don't really exist in that way here, especially this industry, because we're a very hospitality-based tourism mm-hmm. industry. And so you don't get those sorts of benefits, those sort of retirement benefits that would benefit you that you could pass on. And to be clear, when we're talking about wealth, we're not talking about income, how much someone earns, because to Danielle's point, you could very well out-earn a white person and not have more wealth than them, right? So you could be white and earn $20,000 a year. I could be black and have a PhD, but your wealth could still outscore mine because you have intergenerational wealth and I don't.
Yeah. Expand upon that, Dr. Cleland.
So essentially, what we get passed down, right, from our parents and from our grandparents is really what matters here. And so, yes, right, I am a black PhD, but at the same time, what did I have passed down from, my ancestors so mm-hmm. that I could perhaps purchase a home? The other part of this is where we purchase homes, right? Because essentially, as a legacy of redlining, if we buy a home in a black neighborhood, for instance, or a historically black neighborhood, that home is going to be worth much less in Miami than in many other neighborhoods like Coral Gables, right? Or even downtown or midtown Miami now. And so, what we are able to accumulate wealth-wise, depends also on where we live, where our home is. It's not only about, renting versus home ownership. It's also where our home is.
Gretchen, what is the experience within the region? Just as these racial groups are not monolithic, neither is South Florida, certainly. And Dr. Cleland talked about the difference that just a matter of a few miles, for instance, can make.
What I can tell you, based on the clients that we work with on a daily basis, is that one of the most significant challenges they face is really restricted or stagnant income. Hmm. And while, to the points that were just made, income is one piece of wealth and definitely does not paint the entire picture, for sure, making a living wage and having a job that conveys certain benefits like paid time off, health insurance, I should say. Mm-hmm. These are stabilizing forces and help get a family on the right path. So that's something that we work with clients on quite a lot. And our client base is not, we don't work with many homeowners. Most of them are renters. Many take public transit. So we're thinking about what are the very early building blocks for starting to accumulate assets.
I have a couple of questions about solutions and about addressing that from a policy level as well. Gretchen Biesing is with us from Catalyst Miami. Danielle Cleland, a professor at Florida International University. Nadege Green, a reporter for us here at WLRN. Talking about race and wealth, the new study out this week finding a significant gulf between white wealth in South Florida and the wealth of households of black South Floridians, Hispanic South Floridians, And how about you? Your comments here on the phone at 800-743-9576 or a text line 786-786-7636. Dr. Cleland and Gretchen, I'd like you to respond to one text here that we received from 786 mobile number, who writes, "I am Cuban American and I have never experienced any form of racial bias. I've been here for 47 years, and not one time in my entire life have I ever felt discriminated against. I work hard, therefore I have assets." Dr. Cleland, how do you hear that?
Well, I think that, you know, part of the importance of having these kinds of local studies is to really look at the particular dynamics of each city. And particularly in Miami, you know, as Nadege Green was talking about, you know, there is, you know, a wealth gap between blacks and whites. But a lot of that, you know, is due to, in Miami in particular, a lot of the federal money that went into the settlement of Cuban exiles that came here in the early decades of the Cuban Revolution. And so, you know, here in Miami, Cuban Americans have been able to amass economic power, political power. And so that, you know, shelters many from the kind of discrimination that we see against black immigrants, black Americans, that I think is quite particular to Miami.
And to be clear, this isn't the type of discrimination that you can see. Right. I think we're very conditioned to think of discrimination as, well, someone did not call you a racial slur. That's not discrimination. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about access and different groups having different types of access. And to Danielle's point, that if you are an immigrant in Miami, if you were a Cuban immigrant, there is a good chance that you had social policies that helped support your jump off into the U.S. So, I mean, when we talk about solutions, what does policies look like and how do policies shape your outcome versus a group that does not have social policies or the ability to take English learning classes? Or even when we talk about proximity to whiteness, if you were Cuban in Miami, there's a good chance you had access to white schools at a time where black people could not attend those all white schools. Right. It's not to say that you did not experience discrimination or all kinds of horrors in those spaces, but the access to those spaces could definitely determine your outcome.
To the point of access, text from a listener in 561 area code. "I am Greek American and moved to the States 25 years ago. Nobody handed me nothing. I expected nothing from no one. And with hard work, I moved to Florida and was able to buy and sell real estate one property at a time starting in 2011. The texter continues, "I don't understand why you keep saying black Americans can't do the same thing again. I started with nothing for my parents and expected nothing from no one."
I'm certain no one here said black Americans can't do anything. Yep. Black Americans can do everything and have been doing everything in the history of this country. Mm-hmm. What we are saying is access to wealth. We're not talking about income and we're not talking about, again, individual, right? There are plenty of black Americans in Miami that you can point to who are highly successful.
Absolutely.
The first black millionaire in Miami was D.A. Dorsey. I mean, this is not to say there's no wealth in the black community or that black community is poor, right? This is access to wealth. So even if you look at the upper income folk, right, there is still an income disparity among upper income folks. So that if you are a black millionaire, your children's outcomes are different than a white millionaire because, again, still access to wealth and what you have access to is different based off of race. And it's uncomfortable to talk about because what we're talking about is racism.
That's
structural
right.
racism here. And that is real. That's not made up, regardless of your income strata.
Right. Terrence in Boca Raton has been patient on line 2. Go ahead, Terrence. You're on the radio.
Hi. I just have a simple inquiry into this whole matter. And the fact of the matter is that she's right to a certain degree that institutionally speaking, we've had issues over the decades in regards to race and how they have access to certain services, yes. But what we tend to not look at it, at the baseline is education. And it all starts at education. And we haven't had the proper education. We haven't had the proper system in place over the past 30 years that has allowed these minorities or these communities to essentially uplift themselves.
Terrence, let me just step in there because education is addressed to some degree in this report. And so I'd like Dr. Cleland to address the kind of that factor of education. And as the research, as you went through the research looking at this household wealth, what factor did education play, Dr. Cleland?
So essentially, when we're looking at wealth, as education cannot explain some of these gaps. I think, you know, to the caller's point, there certainly should be more emphasis on equalizing education. And that certainly is, you know, something that we, you know, can look at. But that alone is not going to solve this problem about the racial wealth gap, right? So as I said before, those who have, you know, graduate degrees, for instance, who are Black, have far less wealth than those who are white. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we're looking at education, yes, right, we want to address education. We want education to be more equal and more investment. However, that alone doesn't explain, you know, this particular disparity.
Gretchen, how does the study add to our knowledge of what has been the income gap or called the wealth gap, which are two different things, certainly, but related to the same thing? But this idea of an economic gap that exists in the spectrum of economics here in South Florida, wider than certainly most locations in the United States. How does this add to that? And where does it add to that conversation, that public debate?
I think it puts a finer point on it. So whereas before, you know, organizations like mine talked about liquid asset poverty writ large, or the wealth gap writ large, now we can say with more clarity, actually, this is where the gap is. It's this particular community. I think that in terms of policy solutions, this now we have a clearer direction on where we need to start and who the intended beneficiaries really are.
I want to talk just real quickly in our final moments, Dr. Cleland, what about those kind of policy solutions, prescriptive solutions? Does this study lead us to for policymaking at a local level regarding income mobility, wealth mobility?
Well, there are various solutions. I think, you know, part of doing this locally is to identify, you know, local solutions, state solutions, as well as federal solutions. You know, the primary investigators for this study, Derek Hamilton and William Darity, have identified policies such as baby bonds and a work guarantee, a job guarantee, as possible solutions to this particular issue.
Hmm. Well, real quick, what's a baby bond?
So that essentially would give babies a certain amount, a bond or an account, mm-hmm. right? That would then increase, you know, their access to wealth once they come of age.
I see. Additional research to be done here in the years ahead, Dr. Cleland?
I think there's just so much. I mean, we really are just kind of opening this Pandora's box of, you know, what really needs to be looked at, not only as far as the Black-white wealth gap, but what does that mean, right? Mm-hmm. Who yep. among Black folks, particularly in Miami, are experiencing, you know, certain disparities versus others, and where we can, you know, identify our policies, you know, as Gretchen just pointed out.
And again, to Danielle Cleland's point, I think it's really important that we have, like, really pulled out, or that they've really pulled out, like, who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Because when you looked at employment in that report, the group that was most impacted by unemployment in Miami was Black Hispanics. Mm-hmm. And it's important because that typically that is not what clicks here. That's not what we're talking about, right? Because we don't talk about that bucket within the context of race as well.
That bucket doesn't even exist in the economic data collected by the government.
Absolutely.
It doesn't go to that fine of a point in terms of a racial and ethnic identity.
Sure.
All three of you, thank you. Certainly not the last of the conversations we're going to have about race and wealth here on WLRN, but great to have it here. Nadej Green here with WLRN, Danielle Cleland with FIU, Gretchen Biesing with Catalyst Miami. Ladies, thank you so much for your conversation today.
Thank you.
We got plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. Lots of news out of the hemisphere this week. Univision journalist briefly detained in Venezuela and temporary protection status extended for Haiti and three other countries. We'll talk about news from Latin America and South Florida next on the Roundup. Welcome back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Certainly no shortage of news this week from and about Latin America. On Thursday, the Trump administration announced it's extending temporary protections for Haitians and immigrants from three other countries, including El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Sudan. Temporary protection status, TPS, it grants temporary legal status to immigrants from certain countries fleeing natural disasters and civil wars. Many Haitians were granted TPS after the earthquake in 2010. Also this week, Univision journalist Jorge Ramos and his reporting team were briefly detained in Caracas after he showed a provocative video during an interview with the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro. Ramos later said the incident was a violation of international law. He and his crew were freed after about 2.5 hours. And then tensions in Haiti and Nicaragua as well continue. WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett has been watching all this from South Florida. 800-743-WLRN, your comments about the news in and from the Caribbean and Latin America this week, 800-743-9576. Tim, let's start with TPS. How many Haitians in South Florida are affected by this? What did the administration do?
Well, the number varies. We're talking about 300,000 people total affected by this decision.
By all the countries involved.
All the countries involved, Haiti, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Sudan. And this wasn't an unexpected move by the Trump administration, because their efforts to end TPS for these four nationality groups was thwarted back in October by a federal judge in California who said that they weren't doing things by the book here. And so with things in limbo, really the Trump administration, all it really could do at this point was extend for another year the TPS status for these people. The question is, what happens next year when it ends again? Are we still going to be in the courts on this? Or is Congress finally going to pick up its responsibility to start addressing this issue?
Remind us what the rationale was that the Trump administration gave when it wanted to bring the protection status to an end.
Well, its simple argument was the conditions that made it necessary to grant these people TPS in the first place had now improved in Haiti, in Nicaragua, in El Salvador. Now, in Sudan, that's a stretch. But let's just focus on the three countries in this hemisphere. Their argument, and this federal judge agreed, is a little lame, because you look at Nicaragua. Oh my God! I mean, we've got some of the most brutal government repression coming down on protesters there that we've seen in ages. In El Salvador, you've still got the world's highest murder rate. And in Haiti, again, we've got political unrest there.
And political protests in the streets.
And economic crisis.
Right.
Which is alleviated, ironically, by having so many Haitians here under TPS who can send back remittances and actually help, as I said, to alleviate that economic pain back at home.
Let's talk about Venezuela here as well. Last weekend, the country's declared president, self-declared president, Juan Guaido, tried to get some humanitarian aid through the Colombian and Brazilian borders. Violence erupted near Cucuta, Colombia. This is what it sounded like. The aid didn't get in clashes in different locations. I believe four civilians wound up dead.
At least,
with
yeah.
these clashes, at least dozens were wounded. Mm-hmm. What's the status on the border a week later?
Well, unfortunately, one of the outcomes of this violence last week is that they have closed the border at Cucuta between Colombia and Venezuela. So not only did we have rather brutal response by Venezuelan security forces against volunteers trying to push that humanitarian aid in, it's now harder for Venezuelans on the Venezuelan side to get over to Colombia to get the humanitarian aid that they were able to access before all this happened. So it's a real muddle.
And this was a spectacle in the making, certainly. Both sides were looking at this standoff. I mean, there was the deadline that was set and whatnot. What's the outcome of this, though? Has pressure been stepped up on the Maduro regime? Has he been isolated even more, if that's possible? And has Guaido kind of stepped into the spotlight in a leadership capacity, both for the for the diaspora community here, but also in terms of international diplomacy?
Well, yes, yes, and yes.
Okay,
what we've got is, on the one hand, because Maduro was able to block this aid, as we saw, he was doing a rather perverse celebration salsa dance back in Caracas last week. So he feels that he won, because this kind of leaves him further entrenched in power. It shows that his military was not going to abandon him en masse the way we thought they might. At least for the moment. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the opposition is claiming, and perhaps rightfully so, that it won the optics war in terms of showing that the Maduro regime is a rather brutal dictatorship, and that is pushing more international pressure on them. And Guaido, as you said, is the guy now. He's making this tour around South America to gain support for this effort, and we'll see how it turns out.
Lots of optics on display that we won't see, because the Maduro regime confiscated the videotape from Jorge Ramos, the Univision anchor who was inside the presidential palace interviewing the president. Ramos said his first question was, should I call you Mr. President or dictator inside the palace there? And the conversation continued to a point where Ramos and his crew were detained for about 2.5 hours by security forces before released, before all their equipment and the tapes were confiscated. Do we learn anything about Maduro out of all this, though?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, what we did learn, and this it was you know, very valuable in terms of illustrating to the world that Maduro is a rather embarrassing dictator and is capable of these kinds of tin pot stunts, as he did with Ramos and company. But no, we didn't learn what, you know, maybe we were hoping, the audience was hoping it would learn about. Where is Maduro going now mentally?
This is Jorge Ramos on Morning Edition this week.
This is an authoritarian government, that this is a government that feels very powerful, that just imagine if they did that to us, international press, just imagine what Venezuelan citizens or Venezuelan journalists have to face every single day, the repression, the censorship.
President Maduro has granted some Spanish language interviews to American-based media types. Ramos was just the most recent one. You've been in these kinds of situations with the man that Maduro replaced. You've interviewed Chavez. What's the environment like in that kind of sit-down interview?
Oh, it can be very controlled, and very intimidating, because this is an ideological regime, both now and it was under Chavez. And they expect you to follow a certain decorum, a certain protocol. And when you violate that in any way, they get very uncomfortable. And in this case, with Jorge Ramos, you know, they got downright repressive, downright dictatorial. I mean, to throw journalists into a room and turn off the lights and try all those sort of, you know, mind games that you would do with, frankly, with people you're intending to torture, that's I mean, I think Jorge was right. That is, you know, approaching an egregious violation of international law. So in that sense, yes, we did learn a lot about Maduro and his regime in those instances. But as you pointed out, the problem is, you know, even if Jorge says, well, I won this interview,
which
in,
is,
in that regard.
He told El Nuevo Herald to kind of characterize it as a win-loss situation, that he won the interview.
The problem is, you know, did the audience win? Yeah. You know, did the audience learn where Maduro may be headed in terms of possibly negotiating with the opposition in the United States to end this crisis sometime down the road?
We mentioned the extension of TPS for Nicaraguans. Nicaragua continues to be in the news. Nicaraguan exiles who fled the socialist regime there, some describing it as exile or bullet if they were to stay. Francisco Larios is a Nicaraguan American and an economics professor at Miami-Dade College. He assists in Nicaraguan exiles.
What is going on right now is worse. This is much more ruthless. The degree of cruelty surpasses anything that we have seen in Nicaragua.
Is that cruelty increasing, and are we seeing more exiles, more diaspora continue to move out?
Up until just recently, because recently the Daniel Ortega regime there decided they were going to try to maybe hold talks again to see if they could. So we're seeing the repression die out a little. They, not die out, I should say, but reduce itself a little, that we're seeing some political prisoners let out. The problem is, and the opposition is very skeptical about this, because they just feel that Ortega is going to use the release of some political prisoners as a bargaining chip to get them to end their protests against him.
Is there any diplomatic pressure that the Americans are exerting here that can take a little bit of credit for any of this?
Some, but so much of the energy that they're expending in this hemisphere right now is on Venezuela. Yeah. And their bet is that they can get Venezuela toppled, if they can get that regime there overthrown, then that'll lead to a domino effect, meaning Cuba and then Nicaragua.
And Nicaragua. Right. Those are the triorca, so to speak.
The Troika of tyranny.
Troika of tyranny. Right. Thank you for that correction. Coming from John Bolton,
exactly.
National Security Advisor. Tim Padgett, watching the Americas and the Caribbean for us here at WLRN. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Lots more to come on the South Florida Roundup. A bill making its way through the Florida Senate would expand a Miami needle exchange, would take it statewide. What's at stake here in South Florida and elsewhere? 800-743-WLRN, the telephone number to join us here on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The 2019 legislative session begins on Tuesday in Tallahassee. Among the big issues lawmakers will debate over the next 60 days include school safety, education, And yes, health care. It is an enormous part of the state budget. One Senate bill would expand a needle exchange program like the one here in Miami-Dade County. The measure would allow county commissioners across the state to decide whether to establish similar programs. South Florida State Senator Oscar Brannon is the bill's sponsor. He says needle exchanges are designed to help prevent the spread of HIV and other diseases.
This has become a roving triage and health center for these people who do not have access, do not take the time to go to get AIDS tests, hepatitis C tests.
Senator Brannon joins us here in studio on the South Florida Roundup. What kind of greeting has this effort found in Tallahassee as you've tried to expand this needle exchange program statewide?
You know, initially, I sponsored the bill to get to establish our pilot, and we fought a lot of the, I guess you should say, the commonly held beliefs that people think that are not true about it. We fought that then about 3 years ago. And right now, it's actually moving a little faster because people see the numbers and see that it's actually working here.
So walk us through the pilot program. How does it work in Dade County?
So right now, the pilot program is you come in with a needle. Logistically, you come in with a needle used, or some people even pick them up off the streets, and then you'll get a new needle. And along with that needle, you'll get some information. They'll say, hey, have you taken your AIDS test? Do you know some people that are users? And they'll give you a naloxone spray, which is to wake someone up if they overdose.
Do an overdose of opioids.
Right. They may say, have you done your hep C thing? And they'll basically, it's a way to get them in the door. And also hand them some information on rehab.
Critics will say these kinds of needle exchange programs help proliferate the use of these needles for the kinds of activities that are associated with drug abuse and the spread of disease.
I think something we've learned in this opioid epidemic is that people who have the disease of addiction are going to use anyway. And what we're trying to do is get them in the door and also get them to use stop them from spreading diseases, whether it be to other users, to themselves, to the community at large. And one of the other things we're doing is we have a clinic there because we get infections from these dirty needles. And we're taking care of these infections early so that they're not in a hospital. And these people, they're not pulling out their Blue Cross Blue Shield card when they walk into the hospital. That money that's usually they're being taken care of on the taxpayer's dime.
Christine Sexton is also with us, a healthcare reporter for News Service of Florida. She joins us from our sister station WFSU in Tallahassee. Christine, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. What kind of environment does Senator Brannon, is he encountering with this effort to spread the needle exchange program statewide?
Well, thank you for having me back. I believe that, at least in the Senate, he seems to be facing a pretty good path. As a matter of fact, Senator Baxley recently, and Senator Baxley is a little more conservative, and at a committee meeting last week, he actually said he couldn't be more excited about the path that the state took and what this program has accomplished, and, quote, it was certainly worth any risks that were perceived. So I think that Senator Brannon has a very good shot with his bill in the Senate.
What about the House, though?
You know, I noticed that the bill was introduced in the House in January and referred to committee in the middle of January. The first committee of reference is the Healthcare Quality Committee, and that committee has met four times since the bill was introduced, but it hasn't been included on any of the agendas, so
it's on this week's.
I'm not
It's on
too
this
sure.
week's agenda, Senator Brannon says.
Is
yeah,
it?
It's on this
That's
week's
a good
agenda.
Sign.
But Christine's right. The House is a different monster, and the good part about that is we took Speaker Oliva to see our pilot program.
A Republican from Hialeah, Miami Lakes area.
Yes, and we feel that he was pretty impressed. I mean, it's hard to visit the exchange here and come away and think, "Oh, this isn't a good idea."
Christine, what's the state need here, the demonstrated need state? Forget about the legislature and the politics of this at all, but talk to us about kind of the environment that this needle exchange program would enter into, that it would encounter in Florida.
Well, I mean, the Miami and Fort Lauderdale Palm Beach MSA is ground zero for newly diagnosed individuals with HIV in the nation. And in 2017, I think that there the Miami MSA ranked first in the nation for HIV infection diagnoses. So there's definitely a need for the legislation. And I think that the senator included an amendment in his bill last week that makes it a lot more palatable to a lot of the players involved, from the Department of Health to local county commissions.
How so?
I'm sorry, Senator, do you want to say
that?
Yeah,
yeah. So we, you know, look, we had some pushback from the Sheriff's Association. They believe that, look, they still see addiction as a crime, right? Not as much as a health issue. And so to appease them, we allowed the opt-in, which you spoke about when you first started talking. Our original bill had an opt-out clause, which was if your county doesn't want to do it, they can opt out. So when we reversed that to be an opt-in, and also some of the things we did, the legislation doesn't require you to do a lot of the things that we do here in Miami, but now we've put many of those things into the bill. Exactly what we do, the giving the pamphlets, making sure we're taking tests, the offering, all these things we do here we found as best practices, they're now in the bill.
I want to ask about the economics of this and where the money comes, because as we know, healthcare is a significant piece of the state budget and a growing fast piece of the state budget. But Christine Sexton with News Service of Florida, how has this effort been greeted with in the past? How have these kind of debates happened?
Well, you know, of course, the senator can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the law makes very clear that right now there cannot be any state funds for the use of this program. And I feel like that was also a way to assuage some people's concerns. But when this bill initially passed, you know, it was the Rick Scott administration.
Right.
So I feel like they had some very strong feelings about the department having to actively approve these programs and the use of state money. So there's no money that is collected in the state budget that goes to this. It's funded through private funds.
And is it fully funded?
Well, it's you raise money for it. So it's fully funded for it to operate the way we operate it
in
here.
Dade County.
In Dade County.
But not in Broward County or Leon County or Duval County.
So
they
one
would have
of the
to come
things
up with their
that
own
was
money.
Added into the bill that expands it is it now allows counties, if they so choose, to put money into the program. Because in the current way the pilot program works, no government money at all can go to it.
Right.
This one now allows, if a county so chooses, they can put county money into
it. So let me ask you this, Senator Brainerd. I mean, no state money with this needle exchange program effort to try to push this statewide. And the ability or the requirement for any community having to opt in to the program if they want to do it. So where are the teeth? Where's the opportunity? Why is this needed, I guess I would say, versus just offering this kind of program to another county should they be interested? Why does the state legislature need to act here?
So it's currently illegal to take a needle and exchange it for a clean one. It's just against the law. So what the pilot program, what the original legislation does, is it makes it legal only in Miami-Dade. So now when we expand the program, it allows that to happen, but only within these the confines of these programs that are established by the county.
And are they geographically controlled?
It's how that county chooses to do it. So the geographic control is if you're approved in Miami-Dade County, you can't drive over the county line to Broward County and start doing it.
Yeah.
You can only operate within your county.
Christine Sexton, put this into context in terms of the overall opioid response debate that is happening, that the legislature is going to tackle, and that, frankly, regulators are also tackling. We've heard from the Attorney General. We've heard from the new Commissioner of Agriculture that this is an area that they'd like to focus on.
Yes, if I may just go back and address one thing that you had asked earlier about the counties. The groups that are authorized to begin to offer these programs under the bill, they would be your hospitals that are licensed under 395. They'd be
395
your hospital licensure laws. So
okay. So
you'd have hospitals who are authorized to offer this right now. I mean, right now the current law says the University of Miami and its affiliates can operate this on a pilot basis. So what this does is it eliminates that reference to the University of Miami, takes it statewide, and would let hospitals, receiving facilities, AIDS foundation, like AIDS providers, to offer these programs. So that is a big change. Now, as far as how this faces, how this goes with what the legislature is going to do with opioids and the opioid crisis. Last year, the legislature passed some sweeping legislation. They really changed how doctors can prescribe drugs and the process to prescribe drugs and how long they can be prescribed. So I think that people will see that there is an intersection between HIV, intravenous drugs, opioids. I don't know what exactly the legislature is going to do this year to further enhance the what they did last year with the opioids, though. I mean, other than, I think, to continue getting funds, you know, for treatments for overdoses.
Senator Brannon, how about it on the opioid side? How does this fit into that larger debate from the state response to the crisis?
Look, I'll say that this was my offering to help this crisis. We in Miami-Dade County are the only county in the state that had a reduction in our overdose deaths. And I believe that this is a strong.
You think the needle program can take credit for some of that?
I think we can take credit for some of it. I'm not going to say all of it. But I think it's the we here in Miami-Dade County have taken an aggressive approach to this population, an aggressive approach on the healthcare side. And I think that's the route that the state needs to continue along. She referenced back to the Scott administration. Look, in those first 3 or 4 years when we tried to get this heard, they were not helpful. There was a surgeon general that was so unhelpful that, you know, it was one of the reasons he did not get confirmed.
Yeah. What are you doing, though, about the supply? I mean, this takes a look and kind of takes for granted the demand and tries to address it at that level. But what about the supply side?
So, you know, look, we unfortunately, I know that there's been talk of attorney generals suing some of the pharmaceutical companies for what they put upon us. I'm not exactly sure where our current new attorney general is, but I think that that's the route we really need to start looking at. That, you know, look, if we went after Pablo Escobar, then, hey, who's the Pablo Escobar of this drug event? And I think that's another thing. We've had huge drug epidemics before, and we haven't done things that worked. I'm really happy that we're trying something different, and I hope that we continue to try something different and understand this from a different standpoint.
Oscar Brannon, a Democratic state senator from South Florida here, thanks for joining us on the roundup. You've got a busy 60 days ahead of you.
I do, and hey, I'm ready to come back whenever.
Christine Sexton will be waiting for you up in Tallahassee. She covers the intersection of politics and healthcare for the News Service of Florida with us from WFSU. Christine, always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And I will let folks know that beginning next Friday here on WLRN from 9:30 until 10 at Friday evenings, we will begin airing the Capitol Report from our sister station WFSU to keep you updated on all things politics and Florida. Speaking of which, here on the Florida Roundup, we asked our listeners what you hope the legislative session tackles this year. Barry G. in Key Biscayne said lack of affordable housing in the Florida Keys. He wrote us that there's a tug of war between business community that need it to house employees to stay in business and homeowners associations wanting to prevent it in their area. Casey in Pembroke Pines is watching lawmakers address the education system in Florida. Casey writing, if Governor DeSantis is getting rid of Common Core, which I'm excited for, she writes, we now need to focus on a viable replacement curriculum and quick. Lancelot in South Miami-Dade County focusing on public transportation. Writing, there should be an east, central, and west train that go north-south of all for Florida, as well as buses and trams. And Eddie in West Palm Beach saying, fix voting-related issues. Make it easier for all to vote and votes to be accountable. You can continue to share your thoughts with us on social media at WLRN is our Twitter handle. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Furtado, our digital director. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Meritz. The WLRN director of radio programming and technical supervisor for this program is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, texting, tweeting, and above all, supporting WLRN. Have a great weekend.